Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only Ben Mankiewicz, who is here to talk about TCM and Fathom Events, awesome monthly series of classic movies here that are in the multiplex. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we dive into the slate, real quick, just memories of the late Robert Osborne really quick. I mean, God, what did he mean to you and to that network and movies in general?
Well, I think Robert meant everything to TCM. Robert really was the embodiment of TCM. But, you know, in a sense, after 23 years, and all of us would like Robert to be around for 5 more years, for 10 more years, but you can make an argument that Robert's sort of work was done because he left this place better prepared than we've ever been to preserve and present these movies, to bring them to people in a meaningful way. The network has never been stronger, and that is a testament to Robert's ability to tell a story and forge a connection between a television channel and an audience that just does not exist anywhere else in this medium. There is no channel that has an intenser bond with its audience than TCM, and that is a tribute to what Robert accomplished over 2+ decades.
Absolutely. We all felt like we knew him, and I can't think of a better way to continue his legacy than this series. I mean, it's so awesome that you guys are able to bring these back because, you know, back in the day, I feel like you wouldn't be able you had to wait for a giant re-release or something, but now we get to see these either in streaming or in something like this. There's nothing like seeing them out in the movie theater. Let's go through the slate a little bit. So far this year, you've already done Singing in the Rain and An Affair to Remember, All About Eve, North by Northwest, The Graduate, and Smokey and the Bandit. All awesome movies, but coming up next, we have an amazing film, maybe the greatest movie or two movies ever made, The Godfather, 1972. We just came up on the anniversary. They just did a thing at Tribeca with everybody. But what does that movie mean to you? I mean, it means so much to all so many people, but why do you love it so much?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm just glad that we got through Smokey and the Bandit because it caused me some consternation because it's my favorite 1977 movie. And Star Wars came out in 1977, and I was 10. And when you're the kid who at 10 likes Smokey and the Bandit more than Star Wars, generally there's something wrong with you. And so I repeated that story again and again and again as I was promoting Smokey and the Bandit. And and people would be like, "No, you're not. This is not seriously your favorite movie from 1977." I go, "No, yeah, I got it. I was not a Star Wars kid. I was a Smokey and the Bandit kid. I was in love with Sally Field."
It's better. It's better than being the kid that was the Annie Hall fan, you know, because that you were.
That's true. That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Although I don't know. Still, to me, also better than Star Wars. Okay. Anyway.
Right. Oh. Of course.
Well, more meaningful to me than Star Wars, but I get it. I get Star Wars. But anyway, but 5 years earlier, as you say, we get The Godfather coming up on June 4th and 7th. And, you know, I try to avoid hyperbole when talking about these movies, but it's really hard not to with The Godfather because it's entirely possible that it's the greatest American movie ever made. And certainly, I think in what I argue and many other smarter film scholars than I argue as well, that it comes right in the middle of the most critical, vibrant, and most interesting 10-year period in American cinema history, 1967 to 1976. Those 10 years that really start with those 5 seminal films from 1967, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, The Graduate, Cool Hand Luke, and Bonnie and Clyde, and then ending sort of in 1976 with Network. Not that we stopped making good movies after that, it's just that then the studio started to slowly seize some more control, and Star Wars began in 77, and Star Wars, in its significance, begins a different kind of era
right.
in American filmmaking. But and then the Godfather, right in the middle of that, 1972, just might be the best of all of them, you know, and again, along with what is unquestionably the greatest sequel ever. And to see it, see movies like this on a big screen in a crowded theater where everybody knows the lines and the moments and there's just one sort of significant, meaningful scene after another. I mean, you get the experience when Clemenza says, "Leave the gun, take the cannoli." Like, everyone in the theater knows it's coming, but it won't matter. They'll all laugh and cheer. And that is a wonderful shared experience.
And what I really want our listeners, that we invite everyone when they go to these movies, because they're going to go to have the communal experience, the famous moments, the famous lines like you're talking about. But what I want them to experience when they go again, look closer at what Coppola is doing here. I mean, all the sort of visual imagery and symbolism, mise-en-scene, all that stuff he's doing. Everybody knows that if an orange shows up, you're probably doomed. But I found some awesome, cool stuff. For instance, everyone knows Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishies. That's the famous line. But earlier, Coppola's foreshadowing that when he gets choked out in the bar, he shoots it through a fish pattern on the window of the glass. It's the guy's working on another level.
Yeah, I was just reading yesterday that, you know, how accidental it was that Coppola got the movie. You know, offered to a couple of big-time directors first. They turned it down. They come to Coppola, who owes Warner Brothers $300,000. He doesn't have a way to pay it. And he's Italian. So they want an Italian because they want to inoculate, the studio does, Paramount does, to inoculate itself from some blowback from Italian-Americans, some of whom argue that, you know, it's stereotypically hostile to Italians, right?
Right.
And he needs the money, so they figure he'll do it. Now, he takes them, the book came out in 69. Paramount bought the option, the book, before it was published, but it was going to be like a pulp gangster flick. And Coppola didn't even like Puzo's novel, right? So he thought, he didn't think it was well written. He goes on he's on a boat trip in Italy scouting locations, and all of a sudden he sort of gets it. Probably not all of a sudden, but slowly, as he's going from place to place, he gets it, and he rethinks what he thought about the book, and he sees all of this subtext, and he sees that, wait a minute, this is not a gangster picture. This is a family picture. This is a corporate cutthroat picture. This is a power picture. And so all the things that you mentioned, all those little flourishes, I suspect that until he has that moment, he doesn't do, because he doesn't feel it. He's not feeling it until he starts scouting the locations, and that's when he sort of got the sense that he understood what this movie could be, and then clearly, as you say, and then just elevated it to another three or four levels.
I mean, if not 9 or 10 levels, it's unbelievable. And part two is even better. But I guess you only have time to show one during the series. But man, oh man, we could talk.
Well, I suspect we'll get probably 2 years from now, we'll still be doing this series. We'll be at the 45th anniversary of part two. We'll show that then.
Perfect.
Didn't you know what the role that De Niro was going to play in The Godfather? He was going to be Connie's husband originally.
Oh, Carlo.
Yeah, and then he lost that part, and he was still had a small part. He was going to be Clemenza's driver. But when Coppola had to fight so hard to get Pacino, that the ultimately made a deal with MGM that the Pacino was going to do a gangster movie for MGM, and they gave him to Paramount, but they required De Niro back, so De Niro lost that small part. And thank God he lost that small part to go make the gangster movie for MGM, The Gang Couldn't Shoot Straight. And that left De Niro available then to come back and play young Vito in The Godfather 2.
And win an Oscar for that, by the way.
Yes, right.
but you never know, that because this Godfather would have been before Mean Streets if he was cast in the first one. So you never know how history would have been changed. That would have
been
really interesting there. All right, wow, that's fascinating. Well, thank God they all got those parts.
That's right. Thank God everybody got the right part.
That's awesome. Okay, cool. So moving on, we got June 11th and 14th, Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, 1959. I'm partial to a Double Indemnity, but God, The Apartment. There's so many good ones. Sunset Boulevard, come on. But explain sort of why Some Like It Hot was just quintessential Wilder, and, you know, just Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, Marilyn Monroe, just God, that goes on and on.
Well, first of all, the AFI says this is the funniest movie, funniest American movie ever. I people should go see Some Like It Hot. They love it. I don't share that enthusiasm for Some Like It Hot. I still think it's perfectly executed, but it's one joke, right?
Right.
I mean, it's guys in a dress. But it's funny, and Lemon and Curtis are so engaging, and they're so, you know, I mean, they make the movie along with Marilyn, who of course had it in her contract that she had to be shot in Technicolor, and Wilder had to convince her that he could make her look beautiful in black and white. What do you know, Marilyn Monroe?
Who knew
she's beautiful in black and white. But I think you're right. I mean, I would take Sunset Boulevard. I would definitely take Double Indemnity first. I'd take Ace in the Hole first, you know, with Kirk Douglas. That, sure. That to me is my favorite, favorite Wilder movie. But look, I'm not knocking it. I am knocking it a little bit. I'm just saying, I don't think it's the funniest movie of all time, in part because I think the movie we have coming up the following month in July is actually funnier.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of simpatico with you on this because I admire the hell out of the movie, of course, and there's, you know, the George Raft callbacks and everything. But I do think Wilder was better when he was darker. I thought Sunset Boulevard, which didn't they have to write under a can of beans, I think was the original script title for that because no one wanted to know it. And Double Indemnity, I loved his darker stuff better than
the Double Indemnity is, you know, is a pretty perfect noir. It doesn't get better than that. And I'm telling you, if you haven't seen Ace in the Hole, go see it immediately. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
And, it's great.
And unbelievably prescient about the way the American media was headed. And that's Wilder in 1951 with Kirk Douglas, who was then sort of just become a big star. And to me, it's Douglas at his best.
Absolutely. Well, but if you haven't seen Some Like It Hot, it's an essential. You got to check it out. And, you know,
oh, no, you got to see it. Must be seen.
We might not have Tootsie or Mrs. Doubtfire, all that stuff, without it. So go see it, everybody. But to your point, the following one in July 30th and August 2nd, more of a laugh out loud, let's say. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I know, you know, you say it's funnier than Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot. Nobody's perfect, though. But Fast Times, why do you love that one so much?
Well, I mean, you know, if the 80s, end of the 90s was the decade of high school comedies, and I think this is the... You know, if Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire are descendants of Some Like It Hot, then all of those high school comedies, every single one of them, you know, Breakfast Club, 16 Candles,
Dazed and Confused,
Dazed and Confused, of course, Dazed and Confused is brilliant. All those movies are disciples of Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know, and Cameron Crowe wrote this script, and Amy Heckerling directing it, and you know, and I mean, again, it's our introduction to Sean Penn, and you know, and attempting to think that this was just a, you know, a guy who could play a, you know, a stoner teenager, and then it turned out he's this actor of tremendous depth. But those other characters, man, I just, you know, and I didn't love this movie when it came out. I don't know whether I was intimidated by it or I thought these kids were, you know, above my pay grade. They were too cool or not so much too cool, but they were living.
Right.
Maybe I felt like I wasn't living. But, you know, second viewing came pretty quickly and just developed a legitimate passion for the brilliance of this movie, and I feel connected to Rat and Mark and Stacy and Spicoli and Forrest Whitaker.
You forget we get Forrest Whitaker and Jennifer Jason Leigh and all these guys. Judge Reinhold.
Forrest Whitaker and Sean Penn in a high school movie, you know, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. I mean, you just don't think when you see Fast Times at Ridgemont High that you're going to see that many Oscar nominations later in these people's careers.
Talk real quick before we move off of that movie, just how the soundtrack, too, because, I mean, man, right when it starts with We Got the Beat by the Go-Go's, you're just transported. It captures that early 80s feel, and then you can't think of that movie without, like, you know, Jackson Brown's Somebody's Baby in the Dugout Making Love. You know, like, it's the music in that is just, it's of a time capsule.
Amy Heckerling got it exactly right, and the music is perfect, and and you know, look, some of the music from the 80s, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. I turned 13 in 1980, so I was 13 through 23, 22 in the 80s. And, you know, look, it's not my fault, you know, that the music, you know, it wasn't the music of the 70s or the 60s, but it was my music. So I feel connected to it, you know, it means something. Plus, you get a little classic actor in there, too. You get a little Ray Walston, who was so great as Mr. Hand. I don't know, it's a pretty perfect movie, and it's a nice, I love that we're part of something that can run those three movies back-to-back, that we can go from The Graduate to The Godfather to Some Like It Hot to Fast Times.
I mean, yeah, it's true. There's a movie history is very versatile, and to appreciate it all is the key to everything. Awesome. Moving on, Bonnie and Clyde. You kind of alluded to earlier how special of a year 67 was, and I mean, all those movies you mentioned blew the door open on so many social issues. The Graduate with, you know, let's say, open the bedroom door with sex, and then even Cool Hand Luke is arguably the greatest, you know, religious allegory that they ever made. And then we got movies like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in the Heat of the Night, dealing with racial issues. We'll get back to that later in the series. But then Bonnie and Clyde, we have crime and violence. Not too different from the movie that just came out, Hell or High Water, in terms of, you know, these are heroes that are getting back at the banks that hurt us so bad during the Depression.
Yeah, I just gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, about politics and movies, and you can't talk about Bonnie and Clyde without talking about Hell or High Water. To me, all of those movies you mentioned, and obviously they have, each of them, they have different themes, but at their core, all of them, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Cool Hand Luke, Bonnie and Clyde, In the Heat of the Night, The Graduate, they are all about different ways of challenging authority. Yeah. And in 1967, that's what was happening across America, right?
Yep.
We were pre-Tet Offensive, though it was coming, you know, on the first couple days of January in 1968. So there was all about to be a huge swing in American public sentiment for the Vietnam War. We're in the middle of the sexual revolution, and of course, most critically, we're in the middle of the civil rights movement, which is on America's television screens on a regular basis. And the idea that all of a sudden saying no to, if you'll excuse the expression, saying no to the man, flipping off the man, became part of a new American identity. And Bonnie and Clyde represents that most dramatically. I mean, these are bad guys. They kill cops. And they rob banks. But in that wonderful, wonderful scene that to me really defines the movie, where Clyde is teaching Bonnie how to shoot, and the old owners of the home come up on it, and they've lost the home to the bank, and he's initially scared that Clyde might shoot him, but ends up Clyde gives him and the black guy who had helped work the farm with him, and they shoot up the house, and they shoot up the sign that says the bank has taken it over. And they're much obliged, and they move on. They set to drive off, and then he says, "You know, I'm Clyde Barrow. This here's Monty Parker. We rob banks." And there's no reaction. They're just smiling. But that right there, they're the heroes. They rob banks. Obviously, set in the Depression, again, an era when capitalism failed America. And something else was failing America. Social structure was failing America. Then certainly failing America's young people. So. A really important movie to look at politically, as are those other four films from 1967.
Absolutely, and not just socially, but talk about how Arthur Penn. I mean, because at the end of the 50s, we had the French New Wave going on overseas, but a lot of that came back over and inspired this whole Hollywood Renaissance that you're talking about. Sort of that, well, they say Easy Riders, the Raging Bulls, but we're saying this before Easy Rider. It's 67, baby. Talk about how Arthur Penn. I mean, Clyde's gun is also often pointing down. You know, he's got that impotence going on, and then obviously the brilliant sort of way that slow motion and that the editing in that final shot when they're taken out in the flurry of bullets. I mean, talk about how Penn was a rule breaker like that.
Oh, that movie broke so many rules. Among them, that the heroes were you know, again, bankrupts. Again, they killed cops. You know, that's not a thing that was a hero in an American movie. Right. But then this was a wildly violent movie for 1967. It is not to new viewers. It will not seem particularly shocking to see this level of violence, but it was shocking in 1967. It turned off many critics. Some of them quickly, among them the great critic Joe Morgenstern, who's just the smart a movie thinker as there is alive today. You know, it took him a week. He wrote a terrible review, and then a week later he was like, "Yeah, I got that wrong. It's great." Which is, I think, a really real testament to his character to recognize that. So yeah, the Penn, you know, again, all these movies broke rules. I mean, for crying out loud, The Graduate, the hero sleeps with the mom and then the daughter.
Yeah.
Like, that's not something that you get away with. In 1966, I don't think it's something you get away with. And we like him. And that's the same with Bonnie and Clyde, and with Paul Newman. He's a prisoner, and that one's a little easier to understand, but we're still rooting for him. And then, as we're at it, we're going to get to it. But guess who's coming to dinner? An interracial marriage, and it's not just the race and In the Heat of the Night too. It's the changing world. They're backwards down there. You know, Steiger as Gillespie is backwards in The Heat of the Night, not just in the thinking about race, but in about how they solve the crime. They don't know how to use an ounce of modern technology to figure out who murdered this guy.
Yeah, right.
And the big city detective, he does.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we'll get that movie in a few here. But yeah, just wrapping up Bonnie and Clyde, everybody, go see Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway, two known prettier people at the height of their stardom. And, you know, remember them for what they were for, not the La La Land Moonlight gaffe. All right, cool. All right, so next we have in October 15th and 18th, The Princess Bride. Hilarious movie, Rob Reiner. Inconceivable if you missed this. What makes this one a part of movie history, Ben Mankiewicz?
Well, The Princess Bride is kind of a perfect movie. And, you know, Carol Kane described as that. She's in it. And she said it's just perfect. It is hard to, I was in a production of The Princess Bride when I was 11. You probably know. Most people saw it. Domingo Montoya.
Oh, I was going to say, are you Andre the Giant?
I was Domingo Montoya in a flashback scene. I was an Ego's dad, killed by Count Reuben. This movie, it's about love. It's framed so perfectly with the Fred Savage and Peter Falk scenes at the beginning of the film that Reiner does of a grandfather telling a story where there's too much hugging and too much kissing, and it grosses Fred Savage out, but he totally comes around. We screened it at the TCM Classic Film Festival, and I did an interview with Rob Reiner, and again, it is just one of those movies that resonated with people. I saw it 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago in preparation for the festival. Probably hadn't seen it in 25 years. Talk about holding up. I'm sitting there. I cried 19 times during the movie. You cheer. Every time you think, oh, this is too stupid, it's just sort of perfect. Cary Elwes was there. Cary Elwes has aged perfectly. Cary Elwes, let me tell you something. That guy looks fantastic. That guy keeps himself together. He wrote a book about it, which did incredibly well because people were responsive to it. Billy Crystal was at the festival, and almost all of that, the dialogue that he has at the toward the end of the movie where they revive Wesley, almost all of it improvised. As Crystal said, they told the makeup person he needed to be a cross between former New York Mets manager Casey Stengel and his grandmother.
That's so funny. He told that story. He just came to MGM National Harbor here on his little stand-up tour. Billy Crystal just did on Sunday, and he told that story, and they showed like the side-by-sides, and it's uncanny.
Yeah, Rob Reiner was laughing so hard that Rob Reiner got thrown off his own set. Like his guffawing belly laugh was getting picked up on the mic, so he had to excuse himself as they shot that scene with Billy Crystal doing medieval Yiddish.
That's so great, and all those things we've mentioned, we haven't mentioned Robin Wright. We might not have Jenny and Gump or Claire Underwood without this movie. So it's a seminal.
Yeah. And again, we just see it. You know, you saw it in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but you don't imagine that these two stars, two in particular, Billy Crystal was already a star, but Robin Wright goes on to become this serious actress. And by the way, she directs a number of episodes of House of Cards too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm addicted to Homeland, and sometimes I just, while I'm watching that, I'm like, that's Maddie Patinkin. Like, what? How is that Maddie Patinkin?
That's great. Well, one day we'll get to find the Ben Mankiewicz Inigo Montoya, You Killed My Father, Prepare to Die.
Yeah, everyone. Oh, no, but I was the father. I was Domingo Montoya.
Oh, you're the dad. Okay.
Yeah, I had the small part of the dad. He's not even in the movie.
That's so funny. All right, well, moving on, in November 12th and 15th, we get... another one that you could make a case is the greatest. Definitely probably the greatest script ever, Casablanca. Those guys were on crack, Wheaties or something. What were they eating for breakfast? Because, man, the lines in that. Play it, Sam, and here's looking at you, kid, and we'll always have Paris. Of all the gin joints, I mean, man, Ben Mankiewicz, is there a script with more quotable lines than Casablanca?
I give you, with more quotable lines, no. I thought you were going to say, is there a better script? The only script I think is better than Casablanca is Citizen Kane. But yeah. but Casablanca has more lines.
Yeah.
More perfect lines. I'm shocked to find out there's gambling going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
How we doing tonight, Emil? Well, a couple of $1,000 short of what I thought we would be. it is a perfect movie, perfectly cast. And those lines come, interestingly enough, from three different writers, four writers, but three sets of writers, Julius and Philip Epstein, who are the grandfather and great nephew, by the way, of the president of the Chicago Cubs, Theo Epstein, always worth noting. They wrote draft one, then Howard Koch wrote the second draft and changed some stuff, but they have almost all of the Epsteins have almost all of the Renault Rick stuff. And then Koch comes in and he beefs up Paul Henreid and also sort of gives some strength to the Nazis to Conrad fight as Major Strasser. And then Casey Robinson comes in, and Casey Robinson, uncredited, he did most of the romance. So it was really three different writers who came together and created this perfect script. But casting, so critical in Casablanca, and not, of course, just the three leads who are perfect, Bergman and Bogart and Henry, and Raines, the four leads, and then all these other supporting characters, everybody working at Rick's, and then Sidney Greenstreet. Peter Lorre. It's just everything is, and the small parts, the Madeleine LeBeau, who was the last cast member to survive, who sings the greatest scene in the movie. To me, there's the great that song where they sing La Marseillaise to overpower the Germans singing whatever hideous German song they're singing. But the band, she starts singing it, and then Henry says, "Do you know La Marseillaise? Play it." And the band, they'll play it, right? Mm-hmm. But they look at Bogart first.
And he gives the nod.
They're caught in the moment. They're like, "Boss." And I just, that's power, right?
Yep.
And that's just, to me, it's a great, because that scene tells you everything you need to know. Like, Bogart may say he doesn't care, but all he does is a little nod. Like, yeah, go ahead. We'll see how this goes. I love that moment. I could watch that moment 1,000 times.
Absolutely. How do you not get goosebumps in that moment? But to your point, especially that Bogart character, it's an allegory for America's involvement in World War II. I mean, at the time the movie came out, they didn't even know who was going to win the war. So that, talk about stakes. But you have this character, Rick Blaine, who doesn't want to stick his neck out for anybody. That's America. He even says, oh, it's December 41. I bet they're sleeping in America. No, they're getting bombed in Pearl Harbor. Then slowly, and I think that's why we love these characters, he's an ordinary person who rises to do the extraordinary thing. They're not superheroes that are,
Right. Everything is totally ordinary, and he risks himself. He ends up definitely sticking his neck out. He sticks his club's neck out. He sticks and then there's a moment I wanted to use on Twitter this morning because I don't know if you've seen Jimmy Kimmel last night.
Oh, the healthcare? Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it was really powerful watching Jimmy Kimmel talk about the heart defect his son was born with, and thankfully it looks like everything's fine there now, but then he turns the last 3 minutes into a plea for normalcy and maintaining health care. And I wanted to subtweet that with, I'm paraphrasing slightly Paul Henreid, but we're glad you're joining the fight. Now we know our side will win. That is, it's what I felt like. Like, welcome to the fight, Jimmy. Now we know our side will win, which is what Henreid says to Bogart when he holds Major Strasser off and sends them on their way.
Wasn't Major Strasser, wasn't he the somnambulist in Caligari?
He was, that's Conrad Veidt, he was, yeah. And he had like either his last movie or his second last movie. He died, he was playing golf, and not long after had a massive heart attack and died on the course in Los Angeles. Really great actor. Fled Nazi Germany, loaned all his money to the British government to fight the war effort, and had no interest to be paid back after the war.
Man, what a movie.
Because he knew the seriousness of the fight. Real quick, casting for Casablanca, the initial press release appeared in the Hollywood Reporter, straight from Warner Brothers, was that Ronald Reagan, Ann Sheridan, and Dennis Morgan were going to play the leads in Casablanca. And there's no evidence that that was. They were almost certainly just trying to promote King's Row, which Ann Sheridan and Reagan were in. But it's a fun game to play. Like, what would have happened if not Bogart, but Reagan had played Rick Blaine in Casablanca? Reagan was an okay actor and an appealing guy. Casablanca wouldn't be the movie that it is now because it was too perfect, it probably would have kept Reagan in Hollywood longer, which means he probably doesn't enter politics. And then you can just play this endlessly fun game of, well, wait a minute, then maybe George H.W. Bush is never his vice president, which means his son is never president, which means maybe there's no Iraq war, and there's no Barack Obama as an antidote to war, and there's no Trump to follow. Like, it's a fun, fun, fun game to play if Reagan had been in Casablanca.
We might not even be having this conversation right now.
We might not even be having this conversation. That's right, that's right.
It would be all, you know, play one, Sam, for the Gipper. It would be weird. It'd be weird. All right, cool. Well, wrapping it all up, guess who's coming to dinner? Since 1967, we kind of alluded to it several times in this conversation. Talk about a 1-2 punch for Sidney Poitier that year. You mentioned In the Heat of the Night as Mr. Tibbs. But here, just as an important part here with one of the early things for interracial marriage.
Yeah, well, during production, they finished production. Such Tracy died 17 days after production wrapped, I think, something like that, 2.5 weeks. And 2 days after Spencer Tracy died, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Loving versus Virginia, right, undoing interracial marriage bans that stayed in effect, by the way, in many states. Unenforced, right. They were unenforced. But nonetheless, the law of the land changed. So I don't know the exact number of states. I think more than half, but certainly many states banned a black man and a white woman, or the other way around, from getting married. So this was a seminally important movie, and again, we see it now, and we just think you're sort of fighting social mores. But this was the law. You couldn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
Loving versus Virginia, if they wanted to get married, they had to leave Virginia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we all saw that movie, Loving, yeah.
It's 50 years ago. It's not 500 years ago. So we are just not that far removed from this. Now, you mentioned Poitier and Within the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. He was also in To Sir with Love in 1967, which is terrific. So he didn't get nominated for Best Actor, but two of his co-stars did. Spencer Tracy did for this one, and Steiger did for In the Heat of the Night. Of course, Steiger won. Newman was also nominated for Cool Hand Luke, and I'm forgetting the other two off the top of my head. But no question, Poitier could have been nominated, could have won for any of those three performances. I mean, it is a truly, truly great year for an actor. And if they'd done the Oscars as they did in the beginning, which was sort of for your year's body of work, he almost certainly would have been nominated.
Absolutely. And do you have a seminal scene in the movie for you? Because for me, there's kind of the one where Poitier's out with Spencer Tracy, and he kind of has a little foreshadowing there. He says, hey, maybe one day one of us will be a president. And that came true. But also, if we table the Spencer Tracy conversation, that's probably the most emotional scene. But when Poitier's with his dad and he says, you need to get off our backs, like that, I get goosebumps.
Yeah, and that's, you know, some of that is reminiscent of The Graduate too. This is also about young people rejecting their parents' middle class or upper class way of life, right? Mm-hmm. That your expectations are different. I am doing this differently now. That's what The Graduate is. Like, you are not putting me in your box. I am going to lead my life my way, which is why the end of it is so great, because they're about to lead their life the exact same way, probably. There is rebellion in this movie, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, just as there was rebellion in The Graduate. It's not take up arms and head to the hills rebellion, but it is indeed rebellion. I'm going to give I think that scene with Poitier and his dad is great, and that would rank second. But, you know, because Tracy died afterwards, and because Katharine Hepburn knew he was going to die, and because as he's giving that speech about love and falling in love, she's crying, and when we now know she was just crying.
Yeah, I heard she couldn't bring herself to go watch the movie after that. It was
I don't know. That may well be. That sounds right. But it was obviously an incredibly powerful moment. Now, in general, I'm not trying to sound overly PC, but there is definitely a white preachiness of, like, the like the key moment in the movie is when the white people, the older white people, come around. For sure. As always, you watch Mississippi Burning, which you think is about the horrible murder of three brave civil rights workers, one black and two white. But no, it's a movie about how the FBI came in and saved the day.
Right, exactly.
The FBI, who had done very little in general to prevent violence against civil rights workers for the preceding 10 years. But it's about the brave, heroic white guys in the FBI. So Hollywood has always struggled with that a little bit. But when you add in the power, the emotion behind this, knowing that that's Spencer Tracy, knowing that this is his final movie, knowing that, he really, I think he worked from, he was promised when Stanley Kramer convinced him to take the movie, promised him that he'd be done by one each day, because he just was not feeling up to it. So he ends up, of course, delivering typically sensational Spencer Tracy performance.
Yeah, for sure. Well, for all its flaws, it definitely helped change the world, for sure.
No, look, I'm not. It's a terrific movie. 1967. Mark Harris' book, Pictures of the Revolution, talks about the five Oscar nominees, includes Dr. Doolittle, but really talks about 67 in film. It's a really valuable book for any movie fan, as is his follow-up, Five Came Back, which is now a Netflix series about the five seminal American directors who went over to make propaganda war films for the United States during the war. It's great stuff.
Was that Wyler and was it Capra?
Wyler, Capra, Ford, Houston, and George Stevens.
Oh, God. George Stevens, one of the most, underrated of the great
directors. Yeah, well, the Five Came Back reads like a novel. Everybody should read it, and everybody should be watching the Netflix series. It's great.
Awesome. Well, that brings us to the end of the series. Thanks so much for joining us. Before we go, you mentioned something there about how you thought if there's one script better than Casablanca, it'd be Citizen Kane. You're a little partial. Your grandfather wrote it.
but it's a pretty good script. You got to give me that. It's a pretty good script.
You were almost destined to become a movie buff and work for TCM with a grandfather that wrote Citizen Kane and a great uncle in Joseph Mankiewicz of, All About Eve and everything else. I mean, did you just grow up watching these with these guys? Or, I've always been curious of, how that became.
No, I didn't. I grew up where you are. My father left that part of the family, and my dad was a significant political player in Washington, D.C., Bobby Kennedy's press secretary, and ran George McGovern's campaign, president of National Public Radio. And my dad was kind of a big deal in D.C., at least to a young kid like me. And so I thought he was the most successful, famous person in the family. I knew there was this movie background, but oddly enough, I'm sort of ashamed to say it took a while for me to realize the significance of my family's contributions. And we mentioned House of Cards, which my cousin John was a writer on for 3 years. He's now writing for Bosch on Amazon Prime.
That's fantastic. There's a legendary DC movie critic named Arch Campbell. He was on TV.
Sure, I know. My first TV job was at the George Michael Sports Machine.
Are you kidding me?
I worked for George Michael and I worked for Glenn Brenner.
Oh wow, that's so awesome! Yeah. Anyway, I mentioned it when Arch turned 70, we had him in. He and I just like went an hour together. But he told this story of he went to the Mankiewicz place. I think it was in DuPont, and he got called into the side room and then got to see the Oscar statuette for Kane was just chilling on the mantle in there.
I grew up watching Arch and Jim Vance and Gordon Peterson and Maureen Bunyan, and again working for George Michael and then Glenn Brenner. That was in back-to-back summers. That was thrilling.
That's hilarious. All right. Well, I'll tell Arch you said hi. Thank you. You've been more than generous with your time. We could literally go all day on this stuff. So thank you so much.
That was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Ben Mankiewicz, WTOP.